The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to the program. Our guest is John Rotolo. He is a member of Barings Alternative Investments, a global real estate, private equity, and real assets platform. And his title is Head of Private Equity Real Assets, and he serves as chairman of the group's investment committee. Mr. Rotolo has worked in the industry since 1998. Prior to joining Barings in 2005, he worked at State Street Corporation in the organization's strategic alliances business. He joins us by phone from New Haven, Connecticut, to discuss investing in intellectual property as a real asset. John Rotolo, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here and looking forward to talking about one of my favorite subjects, investing in intellectual property.
Well, you know, it's also a topic that we have never written about or done a podcast about, so we're also excited to hear a little bit more about why intellectual property is even considered a real asset. Talk about the rationale for considering, if you're an investor, and clearly Barings is in that camp, you obviously have a rationale for considering something as intangible as intellectual property as a real asset. Talk about the rationale.
It's a great question, and it's a question we get on a regular basis for investors. It's something we've been doing for well over a decade, but I think it's very much still a new concept, investing into intellectual property assets directly for investors. I think starting point is the real assets asset class is still very much in its infancy. There aren't great benchmarks, and there really aren't consistent definitions across the investor or the investment manager landscape for what encompasses real assets. We've done a lot of research on the real asset space over the past decade, which has covered things like the potential to mitigate inflation risk with real assets, the portfolio diversification benefits, both within a broader investment portfolio, but also within a real assets portfolio itself, because it is a rich and diverse investment universe. There's a lot of portfolio construction opportunities. And then, of course, the definition of real assets. And where we've landed is not a single definition, but instead a set of properties or characteristics that helps us classify investments as real assets. And so not every real asset has all of these traits, but the five traits that you'll hear us talk about are, first, we'd like to see an asset that's positively correlated with U.S. or European price inflation. Second, the asset's likely to preserve value during periods of macroeconomic instability. People look to real assets as a store of value. The asset should benefit from increasing scarcity of production inputs. So the great example that we talk about there is commodities, supply declines, and there's a price response. The asset should be essential to the economy or the economic infrastructure in some way. And then lastly, we're looking for things that have long-term investment potential that are used by investors to match their long-term liabilities. So trying to bring an asset liability matching concept to the definition. And when we look at intellectual property in that framework and sort of quote-unquote score it, it scores very similarly to infrastructure, which is one of the larger groups of assets that investors have come to think of in the real asset investment universe. You know, we've seen over time preservation of value during macroeconomic instability. We see intellectual property as being essential to economic activity today, particularly in a knowledge economy. And then lastly, a lot of the assets are very long duration assets. Actually, some of the best ways to get long duration into your portfolio, if you're that type of investor is through intellectual property investments. And so when we look at how it sets up, how intellectual property sets up relative to other types of real assets, we think it scores very well and has very similar properties to some of the bigger groups of assets that investors have come to think of in the real asset universe.
Well, let's talk about what types of IP lend themselves especially well to real asset investing. And maybe the easiest way to ask this question is for you to tell us what type of IP Barings has invested in, what kind of intellectual property has Barings invested in that is in the real assets bucket for you guys?
Sure. So I think, you know, one of the things we love about the intellectual property universe is it is a big and diverse investment universe. And so when we talk about what types of intellectual property lend itself to real asset investing, I think a lot of that is going to be driven by what the outcome is that an investor is looking for out of their real asset portfolio. So today we see some investors who are thinking of real assets as more similar to their private equity portfolio, and they're targeting very high absolute returns, 15-20% absolute returns. And then we see other investors who are looking at the real asset universe and thinking of it much more along the lines of what I think investors would tend to think of as core real estate, so looking for 7-8% returns. And so I think what types of intellectual property you want to invest in really is a function of what the outcome you're trying to deliver is. But, you know, I think fortunately for investors, the intellectual property universe gives investors a lot of tools to try and deliver those different outcomes. I think also, you know, it's just useful to just touch on the size of the market because there's not great benchmarks. There's not easy ways for investors to understand how big is the investable universe. So one of the statistics that's public and easy for people to go and look at that we'd like to point people to is, so in 2013, the BEA changed how they were accounting for U.S. GDP, and they revised that accounting to include fixed investment in long-lived intellectual property. And this is the first time you've seen a big government agency in the U.S. really be specific about intellectual property investing on the economy's balance sheet. And that change actually revised U.S. GDP estimates up by $560 billion. So it's just as an annual number, you can see it's a very large part of our economy today. And it, you know, part of the reason why we like it as an investable universe. But maybe to put a little more detail on what we focused on the past 10 to 15 years, you know, for us at a high level, we're usually targeting returns for our investors that live somewhere in between that sort of core real estate and private equity world. And to do that, that means we're typically targeting investments that are in intellectual property with proven and established history. So what does that mean? Well, for example, we invest in the healthcare sector in pharmaceutical patents, but we would really only invest in things that are through FDA approval, investing in drugs that are being marketed today. So we want to own the intellectual property behind those drugs. But we're not looking to take risk earlier stage in the life of that intellectual property, right? Similarly, we invest in existing media assets, such as film and television catalogs or music rights. So over the last decade plus, we've built a very large portfolio of music rights that we own. And, you know, these include some great timeless works. When we talk about proven intellectual property, some of the types of things that we own would include the music to The Sound of Music, Creedence Clearwater Revival's music, so think of the song Fortunate Son. Maybe a little bit more contemporary into the 80s, we own part of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, or the song Eye of the Tiger by Survivor. So things that are proven where we can assess the history of earnings on these assets and do a discounted cash flow forecast of what our expected earnings are, much the way that you would be able to do for any other type of real asset investment.
Now, you cited the BEA along the way there. You're talking about the Bureau of Economic Analysis. Is that what you were citing, John?
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay, so let me back up 1 minute. When you're talking about the five characteristics of real asset investing, the first one, I believe, and correct me if I'm remembering this wrong, is correlation with appreciation in Europe and Asia. Is that correct? And can you explain that a little bit more detail?
So I think the point there is, you know, we're looking for assets that are potentially correlated with inflation in the U.S. and Europe. When we think about inflation, and it's a complicated topic, our view is investors really need to have a multidimensional understanding of real assets to be effective in mitigating inflation risk in their portfolio. So a problem with investment strategies that just focus on one type of asset, let's say real estate or commodities. Maybe you're interested in gold. The problem with investment strategies that just focus on one type of real asset is that inflation can have many causes. You could have cost push, demand pull, inflation driven by external trade imbalances or macroeconomic instability. And so as an investor, I think you need to be thoughtful and ask yourself, which inflation risk do you want to mitigate? Gold could be a good hedge against inflation caused by an external trade imbalance. But it's not clear gold's good as a hedge against wage-driven cost-push inflation. And so if you don't know what type of inflation you want to hedge against and when you think that inflation risk may appear in your portfolio, we think investors need to have a diversified approach to mitigating that inflation risk. And what we found in our research is intellectual property actually has a very low correlation to inflation. And so in environments like we've been in for the past decade, where the inflation environment is fairly uncertain and there's a good push-pull between deflationary risk and inflationary risk, having an asset in your portfolio like intellectual property has performed very well, whereas if you had put something in your portfolio that you expected to have a high correlation with inflation, perhaps you might have underperformed what your underwritten expectations were because of the lack of inflation.
Interesting. Okay, so let me ask you this. I would imagine that one of the first things that might come to an investor's mind is the difficulty in protecting intellectual property. You hear all the time about lawsuits, major scale lawsuits between technology companies being one example, but lawsuits where people say that's our intellectual property and it's been stolen or it's been applied in some way that is not legal. What about the legality of that? What about the threat of it of intellectual property being stolen or not being paid for? How does Barings deal with something like that? Or what would you say to an investor to assuage their concerns in that area?
It's a very important part of what types of intellectual property we're considering for investment. So I think in the technology patent space, where you've had a lot of very public disputes between technology companies over the rights to various patents, the legal framework for protecting those rights has changed substantially over the last 10 to 15 years. And I think it's become much harder as an owner of those assets to protect those assets. And so that is a part of our portfolio that we have substantially I guess, underweighted if there was a benchmark for intellectual property investing. It represents a very small part of what we do is investing in the technology space for patents. In healthcare, so you think about pharmaceuticals, there's less risk there. There does remain a meaningful amount of risk in generic drug companies trying to challenge the patents for a particular drug at any point in time. So I think the easiest way outside of doing a lot of diligence and working with experts in terms of intellectual property law, the easiest way to manage that risk is to diversify your portfolio and in certain cases to even participate in the generic drug market ahead of a generic drug competitor coming into the market for your drug, so to deter future competition or future legal action against your drug. In music, I think or film and television, the entertainment space, the risk people would be familiar with would be piracy. And that's a technology-driven risk that's been really started when Napster showed up on the scene in 1998. I think our view has been, and we've been validated over the past few years in this, that technology can be a force for good in distributing the media intellectual property that you own, not just a force for people to steal it from you. And so we've seen this tremendous growth in digital distribution of media content, both visual and audio, visual and audio content that has driven great growth in earnings of those assets. And so I think you need to look at what the driver of the risk is and how that driver could potentially be turned in your favor in any particular industry. But it's certainly a very important part of assessing the risk and the risk-adjusted returns in intellectual property. And then obviously there's a geographic component to this as well. The generalizations I've made have really been North American-centric. I think as you move outside of the U.S., the intellectual property landscape becomes more complicated, not always worse. In some cases, it's better. I think today, for example, a lot of technology patent owners would tell you that the European Union is doing a much better job protecting the rights of inventors and patent holders than the U.S. system is. In the case of media rights, if you own a song or use a copyright, in some countries you have much longer copyright protection than you do in other countries. And so, again, for us, that's really a diversification opportunity. It is a global business in terms of investing in intellectual property, and you need to bring the expertise to help build the best exposures for your investors that you can, thinking about different types of intellectual property, different types of contracts around those intellectual property rights, and then geographic diversification.
So obviously IP needs to produce cash flow. That's what it's all about. Talk about how cash flow is produced. Why don't we talk about, you've been referring to pharmaceutical patents and music, ownership of music. Why don't you use those as a couple of examples, John? How do they produce cash flow? I think on some level people kind of understand it, but it sounds like in the case of drug development, you own perhaps a piece of that compound or that puzzle. So how does that work?
I think like a lot of other real assets, it's really about a renting of your asset. So if you own a commercial real estate building, you're going to try and have multiple tenants renting space from you. If you own an intellectual property right, you want to try and achieve the same thing. We don't call it rent. We call it generating royalty income. So you license an intellectual property asset to create a royalty. In the pharmaceutical sector, as you said, you very often will only own a portion of a compound, and I guess you can think about how drugs are developed. Maybe it's an oversimplification. A university researcher develops a compound. They think that compound is promising, so they're going to patent it. The university then may, in turn, license that compound to a drug development company who is going to spend the money and take the risk to go from idea through phase 1, 2, and 3 of clinical trials in the U.S. With the FDA. And sometime during phase 3, a big pharmaceutical company might show up and say, that compound's really interesting to us given the type of franchise that we're trying to build. We'd like to license it from you, drug development company, or we'd like to buy it from you, drug development company. And then the big pharma company will, which are, you know, in many ways they're marketing and branding companies, they'll go out and promote and exploit the patent in the form of selling the drug, and will pay a royalty to the ultimate owner, either through some of those intermediaries like the university or the drug development company, or directly to the owner depending on what the structure is. And those royalties are typically a percentage of the sales of the drug. Very often they will have minimum royalty payments that are due for some portion of the contract, and then you'll participate both in the success and failure of the pharmaceutical company's efforts to sell the drug. Those contracts are typically for the life of the compound. Depending on what the drug is and how likely it is to have global applications based on the different regulatory frameworks that exist in different countries for approving drugs, the drug developer or the university may choose to license the drug first to just be sold in one territory. So maybe they'll start in the U.S. and see if the company is successful selling it, and then they may try to license it to different drug companies in different territories, or they may choose to do a global license with just one firm. So you can have, from one intellectual property asset, you can wind up with multiple royalty streams depending on what the particular asset is. And there's a growing world of securitizations of those royalties as well. It's quite a big market when you think about the size of the pharmaceutical industry. Music, a little bit different, but conceptually the same. You have a songwriter who will create a song, and they most often will partner with a music publisher to promote their song, get somebody to record it and perform it if the songwriter themselves are not a performer, or they'll partner with a record label and perform it themselves and try and release that song today, you know, digitally and physically in the past, physically. Music royalties, however, have a much more diversified earning stream in that as an owner of a song, not only are you going to get paid when somebody downloads it on iTunes or streams it on Spotify, but you're also going to get paid if that song is used in a television commercial, if it's played on the radio, both terrestrial and satellite radio, so on Sirius XM here in the U.S., if the song is used in a movie, if it's used in a video game, etc. There's an enormous number of applications for music being repurposed into other types of content where the creator and owner of the copyright has the potential to get paid royalties. And so you can create a very attractive, diversified, global earnings base off of one asset if the successful asset. We like to think of and, you know, when we talk about our music copyright portfolio, we like to think of each copyright as its own little business, because you do have so many lines of business where you can earn money with that type of asset.
What other types of intellectual property is Barings looking to invest in? Are there some new areas, some new IP that Barings is examining at this point, and or in the process of making a move on?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. So historically we have invested in technology patents in the past. We've touched other types of intellectual property rights. So for example, you can own the rights to the name and likeness of a celebrity, sort of alive or deceased. There are other types of intellectual property, for example, art, which, you know, you could own the rights, you can own it, the artwork itself or the rights to the image, depending on the type of artwork it is. But I would say for the most part, our current focus remains in the media and entertainment space, and then in the pharmaceutical space. We see really good fundamentals in both of those industries right now. They're large. They both present really interesting opportunities for diversification, and where we're spending our time is thinking about how to build different exposures by going into other parts of those markets. So, for example, over the past 5 years in the music market, we've built a market-leading presence in some specialized segments like film scores, so owning the rights to the original classical music that a film is set to, or in musical theater as well. So the focus for us has been expanding on our expertise, focusing on the markets where we've got the most conviction in the fundamentals, rather than participating in what might be smaller or, in our view, more risky parts of the intellectual property investment universe.
You mentioned the likeness of famous people, and I remember 60 Minutes did a segment on this, and they said, hands down, the people who represent many of these celebrities said, hands down, the number one most valuable likeness is that of Albert Einstein. I imagine that our listeners are probably wondering, what in your music library throws off more money, more cash flow than any other? Is there a song that you can identify, John, that is the number one producer of cash flow?
So it's a good question. It will vary year by year, and so because you can generate so many different types of licenses, and you can have things that are short-term licenses that can cause a temporary increase in earnings. So, for example, you license a song into a television commercial, you can get paid quite a bit of money in a one-time payment. It's a little bit noisy, but it is the classics, things that have real cultural value that continue to earn, and where the earnings continue to grow. So, a great example, and one of our best earners is the music of Creedence Clearwater Revival. Very, very much iconic act for a particular moment in time that has a lot of importance historically for the U.S. That catalog of rights continues to perform extremely well. Another classic, which is usually at the top of the list, is the songs from the musical The Sound of Music continue to be extremely popular, generating royalties in lots of different ways all around the world.
Interesting. How about from a drug standpoint? Is there a particular compound, a particular drug out there, an antidepressant, erectile dysfunction drug that is the number one moneymaker for you guys?
We've tended to focus on, because of our view of how the healthcare system is evolving and the U.S. focus, we've tended to stay away from blockbuster drugs and really focus on drugs that may not be sort of household names, but are have a high level of efficacy delivered at a very in a very cost-effective way. And so, the portfolio of brands includes some great some great drugs, but probably things that would not be household names in the way that you might be thinking.
What do they do for people? Are you thinking in terms of maybe like a anti-anxiety drug, like a Klonopin or Ativan? Can you at least classify it?
Where we tend to focus in terms of clinical areas is where we see people who, once they're prescribed a drug that works well for them, their doctors are unlikely to change the prescribing habits just because something new comes about. So that does touch quite a bit on things like mental health, where if a drug is working and helping a patient, the cost-benefit of switching drugs may not be worthwhile. There are other areas where, because of the sensitivity of the body to certain compounds, again, switching costs are high, so treatments and things like epilepsy as well. And then we'll look at areas that might be overlooked. So, for example, oncology is obviously a very big part of the healthcare treatment system in the U.S., but the focus from the drug companies is very often on the delivery of the cancer treatment. For those of us who have had family members or friends who've been treated for cancer, there are a lot of side effects, and there's a whole class of drugs that are just there to help patients deal with the side effects of those primary treatments. And we think things like that are very important, deliver real value to the user, but maybe are not the focus for the big pharma companies. Create some value opportunities for us to go and find interesting investments.
Last question, John. I'm wondering, is Barings expanding the library for music and the portfolio for pharmaceuticals, or are you pretty much static as far as that goes and looking entirely to other areas?
We're actively looking to grow our presence in those parts of the intellectual property market. We think the fundamentals are very good. There are different fundamental drivers in music. It's really the transition from physical to digital distribution, which creates a higher margin for owners and distributors of music, and a bigger user base that you can access at a much lower cost. In healthcare, it's the longevity economy, and increasingly you see the maturation of the global middle class, emerging market consumers consuming a more traditional Western basket of goods, travel, leisure, healthcare. And so a lot of the growth we're seeing in opportunities in healthcare space are in emerging markets, but really taking intellectual property assets that you own today where maybe there wasn't a market opportunity in the past in emerging markets, and now trying to access emerging markets with those same assets.
Our guest has been John Rotolo. He is head of private equity in real assets at Barings Alternative Investments. And, John, they say sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You've gotten a piece of at least two of those markets. So it sounds like Barings is in a good jet stream right now. I appreciate your taking the time and explaining intellectual property as a real asset to us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you inviting me to do so.